Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable everyday terms for regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today, we're talking about the potential barrage of litigation coming after Election Day, regardless of who wins at the polls. How will state and federal courts handle these legal challenges? And what will be the role of the U.S. Supreme Court? Judge Gail, we're taping this on Friday before the Tuesday Election Day. And so we have no idea how things are going to come out. But I think one thing for sure is that we know that there is going to just be a raft of litigation, regardless who wins.
I think that it is absolutely fair, Tom, to say we are buckled up and expecting that state courts and perhaps even federal courts and almost certainly the Supreme Court is going to see a lot of filing action from both sides. If what we've been seeing by way of trends is true and that this is perhaps one of the closest elections in history that we've seen, I don't know that it's very likely there's going to be a landslide one way or another that really solidly, definitively, unequivocally provides one side or another that firm footing to know that they have put the election away. So I think that there's definitely going to be some efforts to change or to modify or amend some results in some jurisdictions. So we ought to be prepared for it.
Let me give you some foreboding here. The Republican Party, the GOP, has already filed 130 lawsuits leading up to this election.
They just have an inkwell.
The Republican National Committee has raised $90 million just for litigation expenses regarding this election. Now, the Dems have only raised $14.5 million, but $90 million and already 130 lawsuits. Now, if you remember, in 2020 post-election, there were 62 lawsuits filed. And you remember the clown group of lawyers led by Rudy Giuliani and the group, all of who have been sanctioned. Well, no,
I was about to say, many of whom no longer have law licenses, but yeah.
That's right. So, not anymore. The Republicans have hired Jeanine Bresso. She's heading the election integrity efforts. And they've also hired David Warrington, who is a former counsel to Trump and a counsel to Trump's campaign. That's on the Republican side. On the Democratic side,
I'll pause you right there. At least these folks are likely to get paid if they're paid through the RNC and not the candidate themselves.
By reputation, anyway, quality lawyers. We'll see what they do once they get their client in tow, but these are quality lawyers. On the Democratic side, they have Dana Remus. She led the Dems fight last time, but they've also hired a guy by the name of Mark Elias. And if people don't know about him, he is probably the top election lawyer in the country. And mm-hmm. Steve Bannon, when he got out of prison the other day, one of the first things he said was, "Oh no, the Democrats have hired Mark Elias." So that's how much this guy's reputation precedes him. And if people out there want to follow litigation about this, Mark Elias has a free website. It's called Democracy Docket. DemocracyDocket, all one word, .com. And it gives you a rundown of everything that's going on. So, but both sides are lawyering up. A historian has already said that this will be the most litigated election in American history.
This is going to put Bush, this is going to make Bush v. Gore look like it was, you know, a trip to the state carnival.
So only 30%, I came up with this figure in my research here, only 30% of the Americans think that Trump will accept results if he loses. That means 70% think that he will not accept the results. I thought that was a pretty large number, but then I started thinking about it and I thought, it could be even higher than that. You know, I think it's a certainty because he's already foreshadowing that the election's crooked in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. Two of the swing states that he really needs. He's already laying groundwork for that.
Indeed. And I'd say consider this, Tom, the fact that we certainly have Donald Trump, who's at least on its face running for office. But I actually take a different position and say that he is running from prison. And so he certainly has, I think, more of a motivation to be hyper litigious
in
these
stake.
Efforts, because more than running to be, you know, to reclaim the White House, he's running to not claim perhaps a cell at Leavenworth. And over and above that, you know, in addition, and I also said, you know, in addition to running from prison, I also think he's looking to be maybe the next CEO of QVC, because I have never seen a campaign hawk so many trinkets and coins for sale. This
I mean,
seems,
Bibles and
from Bible to tennis shoes and everything
tennis shoes
in between,
or sneakers or whatever they're called these days,
watches, handkerchiefs. I'm thinking next is going to be, you know, a vial of olive oil turned blessed oil is going to be, you know, tweezers or, you know, nail clippers. It'll be hoodies for more street cred. It'll be, again, you know, something to maybe complement the gold sneakers. But this is a campaign that I promise you, I've heard of campaigns having swag, right? We've all seen it. And they say, you know, go to our shop and get a bumper sticker or, you know, or a t-shirt. But have you ever seen a campaign seek to sell you a six-figure watch? Or $200 tennis shoes. And I said, this is putting QVC to shame. Or maybe this
or
is
a $60 Bible, right?
Right. Which, by the way, is made in China. And right. So this is shocking to me that this is where we are. But I say either this is the longest, most extended audition to be the next CEO of QVC, or to be maybe the next judge on Shark Tank, because this is absolutely the best effort to sell the American people some kind of trinket or some kind of memento from this campaign, all in the name of unique fundraising that I've ever seen before. And so, you know, this is, you know, and if in fact, and I genuinely believe this, if in fact certain people have their way, you know, our comments here on this podcast are going to come back to haunt us, because dictators don't like it when you talk about them.
Well, that's all right. I'm already on the list. I'm already part of the enemy within, I'm afraid. But let me just say that, and this is interesting strategy, but both sides are prepared, and there's some differences this time than there were in 2020. One, the Democrats are in control of the Senate. That was not true in 2020. We have the vice president sitting as the head of the Senate. That was not true in 2020. Pence was the VP, and we had to rely on his good judgment. We have a Democrat in the White House, which was different. Trump was controlling the White House and both houses of Congress last time. So there are some differences, but I think that the litigation is going to be fierce. And as a precursor to what's going to happen afterwards, let's look just a minute at what's happened before the election. As I mentioned, the 130 lawsuits filed by Republicans, they've really, if you put them in baskets for people in our audience to understand, they've really been in three baskets. The Republicans have targeted overseas voting and when that voting comes in. They have targeted mail-in ballots and when those ballots come in. Do they have to be in on election day or can there be a grace period afterwards? And then the third basket or bucket has been purging election rolls. Those have been the three things so far. Do you think some of those will continue or will we see a shift?
Oh, I absolutely think we'll continue to see those aggressive moves to limit essentially access to the franchise, because that's essentially what each of those efforts seek to do. Whether you are an American citizen and you're physically placed overseas, and therefore it there is a delay in ensuring that your ballot is actually reached to your Board of Elections on time for election day. as it relates to whether or not, as an American citizen, and you are not overseas, but rather, you know, maybe in your home state, or maybe you're a college student and you still vote in your home state and you requested a mail-in ballot, and for whatever reason, the United States Postal Service has not delivered the ballot by election day. And then finally, again, trying to limit those who can actually participate and continue to participate in the franchise by essentially indicating that if you, you know, have not participated regularly or to a degree of frequency as determined by, you know, some individuals, then you are now no longer listed on the voter rolls. And you may not even have received notice of that. You may not have received notice that you were purged or removed from the voter rolls until you show up on election day. And if your state does not offer same day or automatic voter registration, you may appear or show up only to learn that you have no ability to cast a vote, maybe other than provisionally, and that vote may or may not be counted. I believe, I think as you said before, and as has I think been indicated by many of analysts, that this is one of the most consequential elections that we will likely see in our lifetime. And because it is so consequential, because the outcomes can, I think, literally change the trajectory of democracy as we know it in this country, this is why there is such an aggressive effort to limit who will actually have a say and what that trajectory looks like. And your ability to have a say is directly and completely tethered to your ability to exercise your right to vote. And certainly there are those on certain sides that are looking to limit that at all costs. I think one thing that wasn't mentioned that may be worthy of, I think, some conversation is how there's been the very, very strict limitation of voting access for Native Americans. Native Right. Americans who Right. in many instances do not have street addresses as we commonly know them. They often live on reservations where the infrastructure has not been fully developed. Many of them have PO boxes where they accept mail delivery. And they do have Indian issued ID cards, which do confirm their identification, and they have the right to vote, but have faced hurdles and challenges and outright obstacles to exercising the right to vote because of the fact that their lifestyle is not one that is perfectly in sync with what you or I or many others might experience on a day-to-day basis. Their home may be, you know, identified as near a mile marker, and maybe, you know, a certain numbered house past a certain mile marker without a specific address and without a specific name. And because of that, they will face extreme limitations to being able to vote, which means that's worse than, in my view, than purging voter rolls, because at least you could register to reclaim that right to vote. This, I think, is an effort to ever keep you from voting in the first place, and is based strictly and solely upon how you as a Native American have elected to live your life under these cultural guidelines.
Well, again, summarizing some of the pre-election litigation that we've talked about, Pennsylvania's mail-in ballot is being challenged. It right now is in front of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. Briefing concluded on October 11th, and so a decision should come out any day on that. That's a critical case. Just running down through, voter purge challenges are going on all over. We've learned about Virginia, and we'll talk about that in a bit. Overseas voting eligibility challenges we talked about going on in Michigan. Supreme Court of Nevada is looking at issues. Arizona also. If you're looking at the top 10 here, we've not mentioned a state that wasn't a swing state. Mississippi, that's they're challenging their mail-in ballot. U.S. District Court of Northern Georgia.
I so want to hold out hope for Mississippi to join us in the 21st century.
Yeah, well, good luck. On some aspects, good luck. And I hope we don't offend our associate producer here, Colin, who's from Mississippi. But
no, and absolutely, Colin, we love you. I think what's so heartbreaking is how Mississippi still responds to these important, parts of participating in a functioning democracy.
Yeah, their battles over whether to get citizen lists from Homeland Security. All of these things going on, and these are pre-election. Now, we mentioned the law firms earlier that are preparing for this post-election problem or problems that are going to arise. You know, it's interesting, Judge, because they've been talking about these firms wargaming and drafting all these pleadings ahead of time that can easily be altered depending on the state or the situation. They're going about this in a much more methodical way, both sides, than they did last time. And what do you think that will cause? Will that be better litigation? Will it be more chances for the election to be overturned? What are your thoughts about this? Because these firms are credible and they're prepared.
I would agree, but I think as judges we can always think about the fact that you can have great lawyers, but great lawyers with crummy facts still equal crummy outcomes, right? So
okay,
you can't really. You know, you can't really make a steak out of a hot dog if it's just never going to be one. But I do think there's something to be said for the caliber of counsel that represents some of these, because they not only bring a sense of credibility to the engagement here, you would hope, and I don't know that it necessarily rings true. And in fact, I think we know that it does not ring true. But you would hope that they could exercise a little bit more what we call client control when it comes to dealing with some of these issues and be able to pare down or narrow down for the courts the more germane or salient issues that need to be litigated, as opposed to the kitchen sink strategy that we saw, I think, in 2020, when we saw the barrage of, you know, 60 plus filings across multiple jurisdictions, only for the outcome to seem like it was on, you know, constant repeat. It felt like Groundhog's Day. Every time there was a ruling, it just felt like it was on a constant loop. And part of that, I believe, was, you know, not just the idea that you had someone who was completely untethered and unwilling to accept a true legitimate outcome. And here we are, even, you know, 4 years later, still talking about whether or not this person accepts what happened 4 years ago and now is prepared to, again, put us all in this loop again to do this repeat. It's triggering all over again. But then I think also if we reach back to 2020, we're also looking at a group of lawyers who may not, again, have had the, you know, the bona fides or the reputation or, you know, the history to control the client more, to limit how many times this same issue was litigated, or to narrow the scope of what was being litigated. That clearly did not happen in 2020. And as you and I both know...
And all states run their elections differently.
Precisely, so which we've educated patchwork. Our audience about, right?
We're going to have this patchwork. That's right.
Yes. And to understand that although what we're talking about generally in an umbrella way is a national election in the sense that, yes, elections are happening all over the country. Remember, and I've had this discussion with a group of young people just yesterday. Remember, there is only one office, one elected office in the entire United States of America wherein all of us have a say. And that one office is the presidency. We do not all have a say in the senators who represent certain states, nor the members of Congress. Those are left to the states to decide who those representatives will be. And as a result of that, the terms and the conditions and the method and manner in which those elections are actually handled. And so it is a matter of managing the expectations of voters and even candidates, quite frankly, in saying each state has reserved for itself the right to run their elections. But because one state does not run an election the way another state runs it, does not mean that the manner that one state runs it is ripe with fraud or malfeasance or, you know,
ill repute
or inaccurate. It does not mean that. It means that that state has designed for itself a process by which they are comfortable with how they run their elections, and they have developed a history, a track record of running free and fair elections that work for them. It may be that you don't care for the outcome, and that happens because elections have consequences. There are winners and there are not winners. We call them losers. But even if that is the case, it does not mean automatically that the election itself was somehow fraudulent or improperly run, or that there was something untoward that took place. And I think that's the thing that's so aggravating, because if you think about it, we're going into what, 8 years of this kind of rhetoric? Yeah. We're going into almost a decade of this kind of cycle of rhetoric that's designed to decrease our faith and our own ability to make choices for ourselves, which I think is what sort of creates that path and gives a permission structure for someone to come in and say, well, this is so wrong. It's so bad. It's so ripe with, you know, inconsistencies that you need someone to come in and take it all away and just run it all for you. That is where I think the dictatorial argument comes into place to say, you know what, you don't even need to have this on your plate anymore. You all don't even need to have this right to vote anymore. Why don't we just remove that and we'll replace that with a single individual who will make these decisions for you, because the system itself is now so corrupt that it can't be trusted anywhere at any time, no matter who's doing it and no matter whose sets of rules are abided by. And again, you can't tell me that one person's argument over the last 8 years overshadows now what has been centuries of a system that has worked perfectly and worked just fine all the way up until then, until you had just, you know, this infusion of sore loserism.
Well, this whole thing reminds me a little bit about how the conservatives attacked abortion. It's just taking little bites here and there till finally the whole thing collapses. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the same thing. I do want to talk about, before we move on to post-election litigation, the role of the Supreme Court. And just 2 days ago, again, we're recording this on Friday. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court left in place Virginia's purge of voter registration, stopping the state. There was an order stopping the state from having people who are not U.S. citizens, keep them from voting. But the high court came in 6-3 on the shadow docket that we talked about a couple of shows ago, and said it was okay for the governor, Glenn Youngkin, Trumpian, to purge the state's rolls of 1,600 registrants who allegedly were non-citizens. Now, people, critics of this decision immediately said that this action of the court was against the National Voter Registration Act, which requires a 90-day quiet period ahead of elections for the maintenance of voter rolls. In other words, you can't mess with it. But Youngkin made his announcement to purge the rolls on the 90th day. So the court said that law didn't apply. And so they put it on hold, allowing 1,600 people, which doesn't seem a lot, but it's symbolic because it will snowball to other states to be purged from the rolls because they didn't check a citizen's box. A similar lawsuit in Alabama, a federal judge ordered them to restore voting eligibility for 2,000 people. The state of Alabama purged 3,251 voters for allegedly being non-citizens, but they found 2,000 of them were in fact citizens.
And that was going to be my question, is,
and had to be added back to the rolls.
To the rolls. And so I think that there is such this aggressive push to, again, remove and to limit and to deny the franchise to so many, that what's happening recklessly, negligently, you know, purposely, or maybe even inadvertently, is that actual citizens are being negatively affected and impacted.
Precisely.
By this. And unfairly so. And again, but for organizations like the ACLU or others, they would have likely no recourse.
Yeah,
that's
it's
stunning.
It's going to be a mess. And I think another thing that our listeners have to understand is that the final certification of the president occurs on January 6th.
That day should ring a bell in most people's
minds. That's right. We've got from November 5th to January 6th for hundreds of cases, not just 60 like we had last time.
Correct.
Hundreds of cases to go through the legal system and perhaps make their way to the Supreme Court, whether it's on a regular docket or a shadow docket, to be resolved in 60 days. That's going to be astounding.
We call that a rocket docket.
That's a super rocket docket. So let's shift, given that ray of sunshine, let's shift to the post-election. You know, here we're going to have attacks on the counting process. We're going to have attacks on what local boards of elections can do about accuracy of ballots and their certification to the state. And then we're going to have challenges at the state level on the certification of electors. So all of those steps that I've mentioned, each one of those is a vulnerability point for litigation.
If you're sitting back
and looking at where might I litigate, all of those points are points of litigation. And, and as you add, you know, the drop boxes and damage to those.
So there is,
even though we've had a lot of litigation prior to the election, there's going to be even more after the election, and there's going to be about a 60-day period in which to resolve it.
And so my question to you, that's unsettling. Is how likely do you believe that these multiple cases, even if filed in different jurisdictions, how likely is it that you believe these cases will really receive the due process that they deserve in 60 days? And we know how long it takes to deal with other complex litigation. It seems that this is going to be not very different from some other complex litigation that most courts see. So what's the likelihood? And what are your thoughts about the fact that there's this such a short window to handle cases?
I'm hoping that some of these cases can be consolidated, but again, back to the patchwork of states, I doubt that that's going to happen greatly. The one big difference this time than in 2020 is that I think both sides are legally prepared. And as I said, they've been wargaming the various aspects of litigation and various theories. They've got pleadings already put in place and ready to be filed. So I think that we're going to have better lawyering. If that helps judicial decisions, then I think we're in a better spot for the rocket docket to actually succeed this time. But, you know, you get judges who are slow, judges who are stubborn. I mean, we know them. You know, we've seen them. We've
never met them.
They've been our colleagues, you know, and some of them are just going to drag their damn feet, you know, on these things. That's disheartening.
But as a follow-up to that, and so what we're talking about is what can be commonly referred to as perhaps the first step or the trial level. I would suspect you would agree with me is that you could probably almost guarantee, because we already anticipate that there will be some level of review at the U.S. Supreme Court level, you can almost guarantee that even inside of the 60-day window, whoever does not like the outcome at the trial level is going to appeal.
Absolutely.
There's going to be lots of activity at the state appellate court level and maybe the state Supreme Court level, because there, again, remains that constant right of appeal. And because the issues are so important and they affect, you know, state and national interests, I can't imagine appellate courts who have the ability to not take the case. I can't imagine that they would decline to weigh in. What are your thoughts?
No, I think they'll take the cases, and I think that the Supreme Court will ultimately, I hate to say this, God bless, I think there is a very good chance if this election is close. Now, if it's not close one way or the other, I think, you know, all bets are off. But if it's as close as the polling indicates, I think there's an extremely good chance that the Supreme Court of the United States will decide who the next president is.
So another Bush v. Gore.
Another Bush v. Gore, and with the similarity that Al Gore had to sit as president of the Senate to certify the election of George W. Bush. And in this case, Kamala Harris would have to sit as president of the Senate to certify the election of Donald J. Trump.
That is paralyzingly scary.
It is. But can I add one more scary thing?
Only if you follow up with something comforting.
I don't know that I have any comfort, my friend. I'm not sure I have any.
Okay.
Remember the famous or infamous, depending on your side, Madison Square Garden debacle of last weekend, where there were all kinds of statements about all kinds of ethnic groups and Puerto Ricans and everything. But if we went to Trump's remarks, Trump pointed to Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, and said, "We have a secret." Now he's saying this to the whole Madison Square Garden. "We have a secret, and that secret is going to help us, but we're not going to disclose that secret until after the election." And Mike Johnson sat there and smiled, sort of that Cheshire Cat grin that he has. Follow up. News media went to Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, and said, "Do you have a secret?" And he said, "Yes, we have a secret, but it's going to remain a secret until after the election." So what do you think that secret might be, Judge Gale?
I would like to say I've got faith in Speaker Johnson fairly... administering his duties as House Speaker, and I just don't. I think he confirmed it with his comments. And although I cannot yet put my finger on what this alleged secret is, I think, you know, maybe, you know, some of our scholars of process, because the other thing is, I don't know that I necessarily believe them to be he or Mr. Trump to be extraordinarily smart or brilliant. For as much as Mr. Trump derides the mental capabilities of others, I certainly would not put him in the, you know, top 80 percentile of mental capacity or brilliance. He just happened to be fortunate enough to inherit a lot of money, be able to blow it, to be a white male in a country that you know, supports him based on his ethnicity and his gender, and
privilege?
Still be revered as someone successful. But that does not make him smart. It just makes him, you know, very fortunate to be in his skin and in his gender. But I don't know exactly what that secret is, except that it unsettles me, because whatever it is, I don't believe that it is founded in fairness or truth, with fidelity to the Constitution or democracy. And I think if it were, it would not need to be a secret. But I do think whatever it is, whatever these slicksters believe that they have come up with, I believe that, just as you said, that there is a squad of very learned attorneys on both sides. I do believe that each side, and of course, you know, the squad of attorneys on both sides are probably keened in or tuned into what it could possibly be. They have war gamed probably every possibility And that, you know, very little, I think, escapes these folks who literally live and breathe this every single day. So although I don't know,
okay,
I genuinely believe that there's a subset of folks who have their finger on the pulse, and that it will not come as a surprise to them, and that I would be shocked if they were shocked.
Well, I'm glad you're sitting down, because let me tell you what my research has come up with. All right. Now, I'm not saying this will happen. This is a possibility that Trump could be installed as president through an election of the House of Representatives called a contingent election, where the House of Representatives, not the Electoral College, would actually select the president. Now, let me tell you a little bit how this works, okay? Let me read the 12th Amendment, and it's a little wonky, but bear with me. The person having the greatest number of votes for president shall be the president, if such number be a majority of the whole numbers of electors appointed. And if no person has such majority, then from the persons having the highest numbers, not exceeding 3 on the list of those voted for as president, the House of Representatives shall choose immediately by ballot the president. But in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having 1 vote. Okay. Now, boiling down what that means, we go back to the states have to certify their electors, remember? Mm-hmm. And the states have to certify their electors to be in accordance with that state's vote by December 11th. They have to be certified by December 11th, and then the electors vote and submit their results by December 25th. If Trump's people can ball up the states so that the states do not certify their electors, not like last time, they had a group of fake electors. Now they've infiltrated the certification process. So if the state does not certify the election, then those electors are not counted in the whole.
Which could reduce the number of
electoral votes needed.
Mm-hmm. And so instead of 270, it could be 250 or 240.
That's exactly right. 27 of the state legislatures are dominated by Republicans, including Arizona, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, and Wisconsin. There are currently 26 governors running states like Florida, Georgia, Nevada, and Virginia. So that number could be diminished, not by Trump winning claims that the election was fraudulent or somehow illegal, but just stalling the process so that the certification does not come in under the deadline. And if it doesn't come in under the deadline, it reduces the number of electors that are needed. And then it goes to the House of Representatives, each state with 1 vote. And the Republicans have the majority of the states in the House of Representatives. That could be the secret. Did I explain that all right? Did you follow
indeed,
that?
Indeed, indeed. Which is, amazingly scary. I think, for those listening, it is more so unsettling because, again,
I'm not saying it's what's going to happen. It's just what could happen.
Indeed.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But I think what we've sold, American citizens is a bill of goods, and we've told them that your vote matters, your vote counts, and that we'll honor your vote. I think, certainly there would be, especially in states that are led by, Republican governors, and even Republican representatives and senators. And I say this because consider what happened in Nebraska approximately 3 months ago or 2 months ago when I believe it was the Republican caucus or the certainly the Republican senatorial campaign leaned on the governor of that state because Nebraska is different from, I think, any other state other than Maine in that it awards its electoral votes differently. It is not a winner-take-all kind of state. They have actual districts that there's one in particular that is considered a blue dot in a red state. And that particular area has awarded previously that one electoral vote to Democrats during presidential elections, while the other electoral votes for that state have gone to Republicans. And the push just a few short months ago was to reconvene the state legislature led by the governor with the support and actually more so with the prodding of the federal Republican caucus and to reconvene them so that they would change the rules in that state so as to wipe out, if you will, that one congressional district in Nebraska and become a winner-take-all state. This is barely, 3 months or so before the election, 2 months before the election. And now, mind you, the legislature in the state of Nebraska is Republican majority. And so there's no reason to believe that if, in fact, there's solidarity, that they all wouldn't band together and say, hey, this is a great idea. Not sure if we couldn't, why we didn't think of this before. And quite frankly, I believe it was none other than Lindsey Graham taking another one of his cross-country junkets to help encourage this effort. And in the state of Nebraska, although there was support from the governor and by several, but not all, members of the Republican legislature, that effort failed. And that effort failed not because of a Democratic push. It failed because Republicans, there were some Republican legislators that said, we're not suggesting this is necessarily a bad idea. What we're saying is this is a bad idea so close to the election. And that the people of Nebraska need to be able to have faith in this process. And we lose their faith when we do things like this. I am, and this may feel like a bit of a long shot, but I am so hopeful that as there have at least seemingly been more and more Republicans, traditional Republicans, Ronald Reagan Republicans, individuals who have really believed in smaller government, the true conservative tenets of the traditional Republican Party, who have now elected to join and support the candidacy of Vice President Harris, I guess that, maybe I'm an eternal optimist because I hold out hope that those individuals who still operate under the Republican banner would say to a scheme like this, and I'm not suggesting that Republicans aren't already backdoor dealing this thing and, lining up votes and support and believing that this can get over the finish line. But I just would hope and believe that there are certainly Republicans that would be so offended by such an effort that they would see the process and see how the voters in their own states have been disenfranchised, how their own votes have been disenfranchised, how they are being looked to as tools to be used to effectuate a certain outcome that is not one that is that has been supported by the people, and it is the people who have the right to decide their own leaders. I would hope that even if this is the case, and it feels and seems ominous, and actually quite possible, quite frankly, because I would not put it past some of these same individuals to at least try. I would just hope, and I would hold out hope that, you know, first of all, we need a healthy, at least two-party system, if not three-party political system in this country. But we need people on both sides to deal in good faith. And if what's being, what's happening is that there is the plan A, the plan B, the plan C to figure out how to essentially steal the election. This is the, these are the same people who are crying fraud or unfair or, you know, untoward behavior at the ballot box. And so
stop
it's the idea.
Steal.
Yeah.
Stop, the,
stop
steal.
The steal. If we can't win one way, we'll win another way. And this becomes kind of the poster child for that behavior, and, or people who are promising a bloodbath if they don't get their way. And if this is not kind of the embodiment of we will win and we will steal by any means necessary, it is absolutely, it is a slap in the face to the American people. And again, the only way democracy survives is if the people continue to buy in. And this is exactly how you can encourage the people to stop buying in to this idea of democracy when they themselves become the victim of theft in their faces. And this would be no more than just theft. The idea that we elect people, I would hope that if the shoe were on the other foot and it were Democrats... If it were Democrats cooking up something like this, I would feel just as enraged. I would be just as angry and upset. I would be right. beside myself that anyone seeking to represent a major political party would actually spew these kinds of this kind of rhetoric and these kinds of antics under the banner of democracy and claim to want to do what's best for everyone. If you want to do what's best for everyone, then trust the people enough to choose their leader. And if they don't choose you, then respect the right of the majority to choose. Respect that right. But if we're not, you know, and this is where we are, it's stomach churning. It's absolutely stomach churning.
You know, we've talked about litigation and sort of tried to foreshadow what might occur for our audience, but at least litigation is in a forum for resolution of disputes. I mean, that's what courts are. They're forums for resolutions of disputes. And there are rules and there are things that need to be followed, even with aberrant judges. There are still rules and it's still an orderly process. What we're talking about now would negate all of that. And mm-hmm. upend, if this was the secret or is the secret, it could upend the whole process. And the litigation thereby wouldn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, it would be...
It would nullify it. It was just...
It would nullify it. It would nullify and disenfranchise millions of people. And let's play the scenario out one further step. Let's say that Vice President Harris wins the popular vote and wins it by a substantial margin. And then we have this happen, this kind of House of Representatives contingent election process happen. You know, what's going to happen to this country? What are people going to do? How are they going to respond? I have true fears. You know, I have a 5-year-old granddaughter. You have a grandchild.
A 7-year-old and a 2-year-old granddaughter.
Mm-hmm. You know, what are we doing with their country? You know,
what are we leaving them? We're leaving them chaos.
And all the foundations that have been put in place by, you know, our previous political figures, clear back to Washington, all of those foundation blocks are being ripped out. Ripped out. You know? And so what are we going to have left as a country? That I have real concerns.
Yeah, that is why this is, again, it's
I can deal with the litigation. You know, that's an intellectual exercise, you know, in many respects. But this isn't. This is a gut check. This is raw emotion.
I agree. I think if there's any fail-safe, if you will, to this, it begins with the idea that a state has failed to certify. And maybe similar to what we saw in Georgia with Judge McBurney just a few weeks ago when, you know, the Georgia election officials wanted to place additional kind of barriers in place to delay certification. And the judge essentially said, hey, wait a minute, you know, that's not your role. If you are concerned about, you know, something being untoward or illegal, you have no investigatory authority, but you do have the right to refer it for investigation. And so he was really strong about ensuring and insisting and demanding that it be certified, that the election must be certified.
At the county level. So you have to take that up to the state level is what you're saying.
Precisely. And so I think what I would say is that obviously for this plan to kind of to fully come together, you'd have to have kind of the alignment of all the stars where you had, you know, several states potentially who that at the state level failed to certify. And hopefully, given, again, the legal squad and the savviness of the teams on both sides, that, you know, understanding that the clock is narrow, that the window is really, really small and short, that there is a requirement to comply with election certification. You know, and who in our lifetime would ever think that this would become the thing, this would become the linchpin to the peaceful transfer of power, right?
The stall, or the certification
of elections. Who would have thought? I know that, you know, I would have never, I don't know that I would have ever contemplated or dreamed this, but that being said, this is where we are. And we are here kind of marinating in this moment now, 8 years in. And I would think, and even hope, that the savviness of the legal minds that are tasked with doing exactly what you've done, which is seeing around these corners, anticipating these challenges, kind of knowing what we know, because obviously the language of the 12th Amendment is not hiding. It is, if it is, it's hiding in plain sight, but it is not hiding and it is available. And therefore, these legal teams have an opportunity to prepare in advance and to essentially ask for expedited review of these matters, to essentially force the states to certify the election so that the alternative does not come to fruition, so that that does not become a reality. Because I think that is that the courts is like the only that will be the only failsafe that will, as I think about it, it can be the only stopgap between that plan and actually hatching it, is having the court issue an order that says and requires you must certify.
So everybody be aware of a term, a legal term, and we're here to define those, a writ of mandamus, because you're going to perhaps see those. Those are actions filed by someone to get the court to mandate or to order someone to do an official act, to take, you know, to finish something, to do it on time. It's a court order mandating a public official to do something. That's a simple definition. I'm sure that purists would say that there's other forms of mandamus, but that's the one we're talking about here. And you'll probably see those in the coming weeks. Judge Gale, we're out of time, and this has been unsettling at best, but I hope that we've at least given our listeners some idea of what's on the horizon. And it's not going to be over on November 5th.
I agree. But you know what? Also, in doing this for our listeners, it also preempts them, I think, to really lean on their elected officials and make sure that their elected officials know and understand that many of them are on the ballot and they fully expect them to do their job. They do not expect to elect elected officials who will then disenfranchise them. And that needs to be made very, very clear as well. And, you know, having worked on the Hill, and I know you worked at the Supreme Court, I think having worked on the Hill, I know that elected officials really respond when they get a barrage of calls about the same or similar issue. And so call your senators, call your members of Congress, and make sure that they know where you stand on this secret plan, because that undercuts everything you do when you stand in line for 3 or 4 or 7 hours exercising your right to vote, or even if you do it at your kitchen table, or if it doesn't take you multiple hours, but it serves the purpose of undercutting your right to vote, and it substitutes your decision for that of someone else's that may very well not be in line with what you desire for in the direction for your country to go in.
We want to thank you for listening to this episode of Next Witness, Please. We always try to talk about something timely, and hopefully you'll come away with something positive from our discussion today. How do they find us, Judge Gail?
Oh, please check us out on every major platform where you find your favorite podcast, starting with NPR, our National Public Radio. We are so proud of our relationship and affiliation with NPR. So check us out there. And if in fact you have access to other platforms, you're welcome to find us on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, or as I said, anywhere else where you find your favorite podcast. Just look for Next Witness, Please. You'll find us there. Looking to inform you about the latest and the greatest that's happening, not just in the world of politics, but in the world of law, because as we've said before, we believe you don't trust what you don't understand, and our goal is to help improve your understanding and earn your trust.
If you have any topics that you'd like for us to cover, or any questions about our podcast or comments that you'd like to send to us, shoot me an email. You can do that at my email address, which is Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. That's Hodson at ohio.edu. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media at Ohio University. Colin Cameron, our Mississippi native, is our co-producer and audio engineer. We hope we didn't offend him today. Judge Gail and I will be back soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.